This is Daniels from Majority Rights Radio with GW and Kumiko. This will be part one of a discussion on the direction of the British political class and the EU following the Brexit referendum. This will be part one because we're going to need to follow up on the implications for the EU given the meeting in regard to Turkish accession that's going on this very day. Nevertheless, there's a great deal of background discussion that we need to set out about the British political class, the dicey position of Turkey, and the potential for Britain and Visegrad countries to resist neoliberal international forces on the basis of our nationalist coalitions.
Great.
Hi, GW and Kumiko.
Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, well, I think that the place to start is probably in Turkey with the news that's coming in today. I'm looking at the moment on my screen, an article which is on a French media site. It says the European Union agreed Thursday, that's today, to open a new negotiating chapter with Turkey on its long-stalled bid for membership of the bloc. The decision was part of an EU agreement in March to speed up accession talks in return for Turkey helping to control the massive inflow of migrants, mostly fleeing Syria, which overwhelmed the bloc last year. So this question that immediately arises is whether the accession of Turkey is the principal interest or whether controlling the migrants is the principal interest. From where I stand, I think controlling the migrants is only necessary in so much as it presents a destabilizing threat for the European elites, and if it did not do so, they wouldn't care how many migrants came in, welcome them all. The main advantage from their point of view in Turkish secession is to expand the influence of neoliberal Europe into the Muslim world. They will try to do that, of course, to the south as well, although that's become temporarily impossible due to the instability they created when they took down Gaddafi. However, I would expect Kumiko, with her acknowledged geopolitical understanding, to have a much deeper analysis of it all than that. What have you got to say for yourself, Kumiko?
Well, I think that what they're doing now is not even that they care about the migrants per se, because they want to have their cake and eat it. They want to have the ability to have their migration and their austerity running simultaneously, but they also want the population of the European Union to not react negatively to it and dissolve the European Union. For a common sense normal human being, this would make you think, okay, well then don't allow the migration crisis to develop. However, we can already see that they've allowed this to happen in the context of Brexit already, the Brexit vote, because they could have avoided the whole Brexit vote perhaps by limiting migration, but they wanted to have their cake and eat it. In the aftermath of it, they've determined that the problem is not that they did something wrong by, you know, destabilizing the political situation, bringing in all of these migrants. Instead, they've tried to move the place of blame to a location inside of your heart. So rather than they brought in the migrants, which is now causing the European Union to dissolve itself, instead the narrative is going to become they brought in the migrants and you with your bad, apparently bad self did not accept these migrants, and therefore the European Union is dissolving. And so instead of doing an operation on themselves and trying to figure out what they did wrong, instead they're going to try to do an operation on you to try to figure out what you did quote-unquote wrong.
What's the
connection? And it will all become about trying to convince you that you should actually remove the so-called quote-unquote hatred from your heart, and so on and so forth. That's why they're going to double down. I believe they're going to double down on what they've been doing previously, because they cannot admit to error at this point. After all, if they admitted to error now, they would have to admit that everything they have done since about 2008 was an error. Does anyone anticipate the establishment would dare to do that? Because if an establishment admits that everything it's been doing for the past 8 or more years has been in error, then why are they still there? Why didn't they just resign then?
Yes, just connecting this to the Brexit issue, there was a report out this morning on the British Attitudes Survey. Now, this is a NatCen publication that comes out, I believe, on an annual basis, and is based on very broad-ranging social research conducted normally between sort of March and October. So it's a long-run program on many, many issues. And out of this report, which is a weighty tome, that gets published around about the middle of the following year, There is always some headline elements that the press will pick up. And in the 2014 report, the headline element was, I believe, if I remember correctly, that 77% of Britons were for, quote, severe restrictions, unquote, on immigration. So the headline element in the 2015 survey, which has been published this week, appears to be the massive changes in terms of social mobility, which have occurred since that time, since the recession began, and also in terms of actual prosperity and lifestyle, feeling good about yourself, which is afflicting so many people. And immigration, of course, is a large part of that process. So this is a slightly more socialized and interesting, less blunt analysis. Now we've got some context, and we can say that immigration is preventing a large section of British society, of all races, no doubt, from advancing in the way that during the second half of the 20th century one came to accept, you know, this wonderful golden period of social improvement that my parents knew from the war onwards, end of the war onwards. And this has all been sort of taken away. You know, that research came out today, and it's extremely relevant to both Brexit and to the accession and expansion of the EU, which would go on regardless of Brexit. So the European Union itself is now almost like trying to escape east from the horrors that are occurring to the west or northwest. They're going to lose a major economic beneficiary, 15% of the EU budget. They're going to lose it. They want, of course, at the same time to create an EU army. That's another thing that's upcoming and is being pushed after the Brexit referendum, being pushed forward. They want to do that, but they've lost the best professional army on the continent. So,
indeed,
you know, sorry, go on.
The whole conversation, the whole conversation about that was indeed going to be about, you know, having the British army near the center of that process, because who else can do most of the heavy lifting, and who has the actual experience?
Yes.
Most of that is essentially British experience there.
Yes, well, it'll come
lost it now.
It'll come down to the French to bear it, won't it? Because that's the only really competent army left.
Yes, although lots of them would like Frexit now, so that's kind of, you know, a thing which they're going to have to deal with, a part of the battle they're going to have to deal with. Another thing which they have not calculated for, because they haven't even, you know, even on their own agenda, they've been so consumed with this migration thing that they have even been putting elements of their own agenda to the wall in order to do this, which shows almost just how pathological it seems to be. They're supposed to be having engagement with China. Now, part of the European Union's worry about engagement with China is that they'll find themselves being overwhelmed by it, because, you know, China has this habit, which they do not like, because, you know, they first started to see this being done in 2008, when they had to, you know, politely inform China that if they should like to deal with Europe, they should not deal with individual European nations on a bilateral basis. They should try approaching Europe from the European level, because they didn't want China to, you know, neatly split, you know, friends from foes in Europe. They wanted, obviously, the European Union to stand as one, and so on and so forth. Now we see the reemergence of this again, because of the fact that while the European Union is busy dealing with the fallout from Brexit, the navel gazing that comes from them, you know, repeatedly talking about the migration crisis and then just exacerbating it further, China is yet again trying to do the bilateral approach through 16+1, which is them individually doing all of the people in Eastern and Central Eastern Europe as part of their one road, one belt policy. And so now all of these people are coming out and talking about how, oh, someone needs to, get on the China issue and try to make sure that they don't overextend their hand over there, and so on and so forth. Except there's no one who has any time to even pay attention to that now because of these other things which they have caused. To me, it shows. I mean, I say that not because I'm antagonistic toward China. Obviously, I'm not antagonistic toward China. But I point this out as an example of just how pathological their desire to bring the migrants in was, because of the fact that it directly contradicts one of their, or at least frustrates all of the other tasks which they had on the table, which they needed to do. Yet they still chose to do it.
There are two meetings that are relevant to Turkey going on right now. There's the discussions of EU accession that's happening today, and 3 days ago, there was a meeting in Rome with Netanyahu in which improved relations with Israel and Turkey were discussed, which seems kind of suspicious. I'm wondering if either of you can comment on the history of Turkish Jewish relations, and also I'm wondering about this conflict between the Kurds and the Turks, and how that becomes relevant.
Well, again, it's really in Kumiko's area of concern, but I would just say that the character of the Turks in these discussions is much more is profoundly self-interested. I'm talking about ethnic Turks, and they have a very much more geopolitical understanding, a regional understanding than we do. And you know, it is really regional interests that drive the Israeli Turkish friendship, whereas Europeans would want to be able to go into this and say, well, you know, this is the way things are going to be, dictate the European interest through Turkey and beyond, to have connections to Iraq and Iran and everywhere else beyond that. As soon as you start involving the Israelis as well, of course, in this, the issue becomes swamped to some extent by the local geopolitical considerations of those countries. And I don't know whether the Europeans will ever be able to crack that, however much power and energy they try to engage in the process or invest in the process. I just feel in the end that, and I think we're seeing it with Turkey now, there is an absolutely implacable self-interest at the heart of the Turkish governmental machine. They know what they're doing, they know what they want, and they do not really vary from it. They believe they'll get their way. They believe that history will reward them. And they have no desire to, really, they have no desire to give anything away at all. So I think it's a one-way process, which will defeat the Europeans.
Yes, that's been their position for the longest time now, which is why people were saying that, you know, Turkey is a country that has connections that go in all four directions. It has a connection stemming from the old Ottoman Empire. I'm not actually reading off the screen in case anyone's wondering. there's a connection to the old Ottoman Empire, to the south where they were in, you know, Mesopotamia, the Levant, and Arabia, and so on. Parts of North Africa as well. So there's the connection they have in that direction. There's the connection they have to the west, which is, you know, the supposed shared links with European culture, which they have, of course, completely repudiated anyway. Their link to the south, they also repudiated that. Well, not that they repudiated it, but more that I guess it repudiated them.
Yes.
Their connection to the north of their position, and by north, I don't mean strictly north, but I guess you could say northeast, if you like, which is their connection to Central Asia, where they talk about, you know, Turanism and all of this other, well, frankly, idealistic nonsense, which is not backed up by any kind of economic processes whatsoever. That they also failed at because, you know, leaders such as Erdogan and the people who preceded him kept trying to forge their links with Central Asia by continually opening their mouths and talking about Islam. This, of course, had almost no effect in the real world because China was just flooding them with money and investment. So which one are they going to choose at the end of the day? The person who comes with money or the person who comes with lots of talk about the historical role of Islam in Central Asia? Mm. Complete waste of time. Connections eastward. Obviously, their tensions with Russia, Turkey's tensions with Russia, have been continuing since the Cold War and have not abated. Mm. And their relationship with China is extremely poor because they insist on supporting the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province, which China, of course, has no liking for.
That's the Muslims, to put it.
Exactly, yes. And so they call that the East Turkestan something movement, which is essentially jihadist as well.
So this is good for us.
So they had trapped themselves on all four sides because they should not have been able to have any influence in the east. They could not have any influence north of their position. Their influence to the south was sharply curtailed by the fact that, you know, Iran had constructed a Shia crescent, and because Saudi Arabia exists. Yeah. and their influence to the West also should have been, you know, not very good, because they did not have a good relationship with the European Union. However, this has been ruined by two processes, I believe, because they've been given an out to their West, largely because of the fact that the West decided to stop opposing Turkey. And part of the reason is because of two things that ended up interlocking together, which are factors where the two sides perceive themselves as getting something good out of it. And so that's how they were able to be brought together. It's not, I don't believe it's a conscious coupling, it just happened. For instance, from the Western side, they believe that they need more immigrants of working age annually for the next 10 years, starting from now, that is. Because they say that the net annual average of migrants into the European Union is something like 0.6 to 0.7 million immigrants. They want more because they want an additional 1.8 net immigrants of working age needing to be added annually. And the reason they want that is because they want to match US labor patterns, because they believe that, you know, everything America does is right, I suppose.
Oh, no.
So they want, that's where they want that increase. They believe that more growth in migrants is crucial to ensuring debt sustainability.
Exactly. That
which also should make no sense, because that's not where the actual productive capacity is coming from. No one ever said, oh, you know, you brought in more migrants and suddenly your production went up. Particularly if you look at their own criticisms of the wage system since the 1970s, what is the thing that they always talk about when they talk about the wages? They say that wages did not rise with productivity. Mm. That's not because of an influx of people. It's because of the fact that mechanization and autonomization make things more efficient and more productive.
Yep.
So when you talk about ensuring debt sustainability, there's also a strange blindness that comes when people talk about this debt sustainability, because they're always talking about individual human beings paying income tax or something like this. It's at this time that they completely forget that companies pay corporation tax. Like, if you want to pay down debt at the state level, why don't you just tax giant companies, which is where all the profits are actually going to? Why say that you need to bring in extra humans so that you can do income tax on
them?
Well,
in fact, they haven't managed to do that at all. A substantial, I mean, you have to remember that QE has been going on quite happily for a long time, and has, as yet, despite all the terrible warnings, has had no real effects economically, other than possibly to keep the ship stable. The fact is that QE, for the most part, was essential to building the banks' books again and getting them on a stable basis. That's where most of it seems to have gone. And an unknown amount, because I don't think it's been recorded, of QE has been created directly for paying off the foreign notes, you know, international finance debts, which are supposed to be paid, of course, out of taxation. It's just one of the fantastic things about international finance. First of all, you don't need to use it at all when you can do QE. We've proven that conclusively. Why not just do QE and tell international finance to go itself? Secondly, you know, they make 90% of what they own within the rules can be generated out of thin air. And lo and behold, when it's repaid electronically, nothing happens. Nothing happens at all. So, you know, you have to say that QE, if it doesn't completely falsify the notion of austerity, it gets damn well close to it. And this is
exactly
something that we've discussed before, but, you know, the extent to which QE could, in fact, Corbyn tried to argue this at the beginning, or rather his friend MacDonald tried to argue this at the beginning. It became known as Corbynomics, but it is a completely respectable way of dealing with things, and the only consideration that actually exists in it is the way that you deal with structural growth, which you don't want to get out of control. There's the multiplier effect, for example, but the greatest multiplier effect is bank interest, and you take that out of the equation with QE.
Exactly.
If you use it properly, if you don't put it through the banks. However, trying to get back to the matter at hand.
These things intersected.
Yes.
Because you know, by employing these foolish arguments that they wanted to, you know, that they wanted more migrants because they thought it was economically good for them for some reason.
Yes.
And the fact that they want to manage all of the local interest groups opposed to immigration.
It's not migrants per se. It's GDP, the sacred you know, article in all this, is gross domestic product. They have to keep increasing gross domestic product, because only by doing that can they appear to, you know, Standard and Poor and Fitch and all the other people, you know, to be a successful economy that gets a decent rating, that gets a decent interest on loans.
That is looked upon on Wall Street as the most important figure. It's true.
From the other side, there's an issue where, you know, Europe is fully accepting migrants because it has internally convinced itself of the need for this because of their worship, I guess, of the holy grail of GDP growth through mass migration. Having advanced this narrative, they've made themselves weak to the strategy which Turkey has chosen to employ because, you know, having bad relations on all four sides, it's looking for the weakest link. Europe presents itself as the weakest link insofar as it continues to believe its own migration narrative. Turkey uses the migration and refugee crises as non-military instruments of state-level coercion. They can turn the migrants on or off at any time that they want, and so they see that as a way of getting leverage over Europe, and they can advance their interests through that avenue.
So are their interests expansive in the traditional sense of the caliphate in terms of ISIS, I suppose, but the historic engagement of Turkey and Europe. Is that still the extent and the way that they want to proceed into the future with regard to the West?
It would seem so to me. That, you know, they have this view of a revival of Turkey. The Turkish nationalists seem to believe that you know, Turkey has some kind of destiny or the other. I can't figure out what precisely that destiny is supposed to be,
right,
because they can't seem to figure it out. But yeah, they seem to be interested in that.
So they're interested in migration as a weapon. They're interested in Turkish expansion as an expression of Turkish interest. And the idea, therefore, that the West should engage with these people is already out of date. We're trying to engage with Ataturk's Turkey, modernizing Turkey, and this other regnant and imperialist creature is rising out of the mist and shaking his fist. As we know from the appeasement of Germany in the 1930s, that if you do not make clear what the boundaries are, if you say on the contrary, you know, we have no boundaries, we want to embrace you, we take you without regard to your faults, we take you, you know, then they will only make their own position harder, and their demands will only increase. The demands upon Europe's peoples will only increase. Their parasitism will increase. And we're going to find ourselves eventually in a crisis of a very old-fashioned type. That's how one would, as a European, one would, and I'm sure that's how the Eastern Europeans would view the Turkish accession under the current political leadership.
Turkey also has to be viewed as not a real country in the sense that people understand it. A lot of the time, you get the impression that people think that Turkey is going to become a European country in the sense that it's going to be, you know, a liberal democracy with, you know, democratic capitalism throughout the entire country and so on. This is not the case. To understand Turkey, you have to view it as basically there's a ruling clique inside of Ankara and everyone else is essentially the peons, which sounds cliche, but that's actually what is happening. So when you see, for instance, all of this stuff about reviving Islam and, you know, Islamic Turkey and so on and so forth, this is done for a specific economic reason in addition to the cultural reason. So in other words, they don't have just these Islamic elements. There's Islamism, which is involved here, because the structure of Islam itself is capable of holding people down into just the amount of ignorance required that the people in charge of Turkey can continue to raking the money which they, of course, deeply desire to make. So all of this is kind of like, you know, the fantasy of talking about a modernizing Turkey. Turkey is not modernizing. Turkey has hit the end of how far it can possibly modernize without an actual people's uprising.
They do say, you know, Turkey is bang in the center of the world from an IQ perspective. I think the national IQ of Turkey is 91 or 92, and that is the level at which it is possible to maintain a broadly technological civilization in the modern sense. Below that level, it is not. So it's at the crossroads in more sense than one. It's not simply the geopolitical and geographic crossroads, the crossroads between the East and West and the Islamic world and the Christian world. It's also the crossroads technologically between a modernistic and advancing society and a regressive and, you know, trapped society, trapped by its own lack of creative intelligence.
Yes. Also, is it possible for a country to be acceding to the European Union if it has internal border disputes with someone else?
Well, that's part of the problem with the various chapters. There's about 31 chapters, I think, for discussion. And that means 31 separate conferences trying to resolve everything satisfactorily until they're all resolved. But in the end, that is a political decision. It is not necessarily a diplomatic conclusion that will decide whether this matter has come to a conclusion. If the political will is for a session, then, you know, the EU bureaucracy will simply declare it as such. They will just short-circuit it in the way that we've seen with other member states.
Yes, because under normal circumstances, if they are presently having fighting with, you know, various armed groups to the south of their position, who claim that, you know, part of the Turkish territory should actually be part of some other countries, for example, Kurdistan, or any other country for that matter, then, you know, how are they going to overlook this? They can only do it by covering their eyes and pretending they can't see it then. Which is what you're saying, actually, that they would just cover their eyes and pretend they can't see the internal conflict.
They will find a form of words which will enable them to declare the conflict with the Kurds as being irresolvable in the short term. So they would take into account the desire of the community as such to find a resolution which was just to all parties, but that they would not allow this to stand in the way of the massive benefits, of course, for all, especially for the Turkish people, of accession to the community, blah, blah, blah. And then the thing would be put to the
And they'd probably cast it not as a war. They'd probably cast it also not as a war, but as a police action instead. A form of terrorism instead of it being a territorial claim.
Exactly. I mean, you know, Ireland and the UK were admitted when the IRA were fighting their war. No problem at all. There's a precedent.
Oh, yes. Good point.
So I don't think that they would allow, if they really, really want to expand the EU into the Middle East, and they do, then they will find a way to do it. And then the matter comes back to the member states for approval. And that's a test of the Visegrad nations and of Austria, if it at that time has sufficient nationalist expression in the polity for and there's not actual expression formally at the moment, but it's plainly there amongst the voters. So, you know, we are being saved, perhaps, by the Eastern nations, or by the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, even. Who knows? It's a fascinating moment in history. And one of the most fascinating elements of it occurred last week, and that was the decision of the British electorate, majority of the British electorate, to leave the European Union, the earliest possible opportunity, and to create a new future for itself, and that means a great deal to the processes that are under development now. There are several of them that were held over until after the referendum because the EU elites understood perfectly well that these would only exacerbate likelihood of a Brexit vote.
I mean, it's so bad. The fact that I changed my position to Brexit and changed my position to wanting the European Union to be dissolved, that should be a canary in the coal mine right there, actually, really. That it's already been killed. It had been killed before Brexit happened, from the moment that that incident in Cologne on New Year's Eve happened. and all of those migrants were essentially running around doing, you know, what is it called, Tahrir Gemeya, from the moment that happened, it was over. That was the moment that the death happened. It was not the Brexit vote that killed the European Union. It was that moment on New Year's Eve 2015 that killed it, because anyone who was still holding on to hope that you could have a European solution to this problem, anyone who was still holding on to that hope, had it shattered in the days afterwards, when there was a cover-up, followed by them saying that we're going to press on ahead with everything as planned, we're going to make no adjustments here. From the time they did that, it was obvious that European people were going to revolt. Even the most docile people will revolt eventually, because you have given them no choice. There is no choice. You've given them no options. You've given them no way out. You've given them only two positions. One, accept rape, or two, quit the European Union. Of course, if no one is going to accept rape, then obviously they're going to quit the European Union. That is what's going to happen.
You may be putting it a little bit...
I'm putting it a little bit hyperbolically, but it's true. It's effectively true. The reason I chose that is because of the fact that the rape crisis, if you want to call it that, most steeply affects women. Now, who are the people who are most active on social media? Again, the same demographic. Women between the ages of 18 to 50 something. For some reason, we do not know why that reason is, but it's probably because of some kind of biological tendency which has decided to manifest itself through the internet.
Good Lord, there is no biological tendency, or unfettered wills, didn't you know? Okay, you're letting down your sex, you're letting down humanity. You must be plastic, you must author yourself. That's the brave new world.
They don't like to think about it, but you know, when they say that there's you know, that what was it, that men had 5,000 words per day and that women had 10,000 or something arbitrary numbers they were plucking out. These numbers
count
do have
up
some...
the words in this interview and prove your point, but it is possible.
Yeah, and so, you know, when they invite this crisis onto themselves and it affects primarily the demographic which seems to do the most talking, why would they then be surprised that it would result in the disintegration of the European Union? Like, I mean, everywhere that you went on European social media was basically people screaming about migrants. That's all it was. Yeah. Female avatars screaming about migration. That's effectively what it is. And then you have female leaders in the European Union essentially screaming about migration 24/7. Marine Le Pen and Marine Le Pen prancing around talking about how they're coming for you. And they're not lying. So, you know, how did they think they were going to get away from this? Mm-hmm. It should have been common sense that this was an existential threat to their rule. But, you know, they're some of the first leaders who not only are amoral, but also seem to be dumb at the same time. Because no other civilization, or at least no other group of leaders, would have allowed this to happen in the presently existing world. Like, I mean, can you imagine? Like, the rulers of India, they're pretty corrupt. Would they have allowed this to happen? No, because they value their rulership. They know for sure that if they were to bring in a bunch of foreign people and impose them on the Indian people, then they would not be able to get away with any of their scams anymore, because it would become very obvious as to what they're doing. It's the most basic low-level scam possible. Everyone notices that one. There are plenty of sophisticated scams you can do and people will notice it. But once you start doing population replacement on someone, suddenly everyone can notice that one, because it's visibly obvious.
It's been going on for a long time in the West, and they've got away with it. They've managed to keep control up to now of the political parties. In fact, what they've done, the final development of this control was the centralization of politics into a single space, which was called the center, but was not really the center, because it's extreme in its politics, extreme, as you've just illustrating. But that's been the modus of control, and it's been the same in America, the same in Canada, the same everywhere, whereby basically the choices that were offered to the electorate were narrowed down to this technocratic or third wayism, or whatever you want to call it, form of government, in which, and I was talking to Daniel about this yesterday, fundamentally what's happened is that Anthony Giddens' vision has been adopted and realized. It's the model which he wrote about in the early 1990s and was taken up by Clinton, Blair, and Schroeder, and was and became known as the, I think, is the Blair-Clinton-Schroeder model. And, you know, this is a model whereby the political class does not take its advice from its contact with its constituency electors. It does not take its advice from its contact with them on its regular surgeries and so forth, or from its letterbox, but instead takes its advice, basically instruction, from constituencies that are within the bubble. So we're talking about big business and the banks. We're talking about voluntary sector, the charities. We're talking about the think tanks of right and left. And we're talking about the academic left, which produces, or certainly used to, I think it's done a lot less of this.
Previously, in order to get the agenda which had been going forward up until now to just be executed without anyone protesting, you had to manage spillover of information, because you had to say one thing to one group of people and a different thing to another group of people. Yes, and not have the two audiences be confused with each other. So you're trying to avoid this spillover. So, for example, on one hand, you had, you know, Eurocrats et al. Saying that, you know, we need to press for deeper, you know, integration of Europe. But on the other hand, you had to have another group of people saying that, oh, well, that's never going to happen anyway. And you have to have these two messages not get crossed over.
Yeah.
But with everything being freely available to everyone to read, it's clearly obvious that eventually documents which usually circulate among the highest ranks would end up being read by regular people on the ground, and they'd become aware of what had actually happened, and they'd find that the reality does not actually gel with the political rhetoric which had been coming out of people's mouths. As soon as that happened, that created a kind of perfect storm of distrust in the leadership as it existed. Then the fact that these leaders started to disagree with each other meant that the people who were in disagreement on the ground were then able to actually project their views onto these dissenting persons,
such as
Boris Johnson, who has obviously now gone, Michael Gove, and so on. That it's almost like a feeling of dissatisfaction had finally found a vehicle.
Yes, it's entirely possible that we will see May supported by a lot of, because you say there are in the Conservative members, there's 332 members of parliament, and only about 140 of those declared for Brexit. A fair number of the others are Brexiteers who went with David Cameron for reasons of loyalty, and we do not know what they will do.
Okay. Why aren't they showing more interest in Andrea Leadsom then?
I think the feeling with Andrea is she's great. I think she's you know, winsome and charming and quite humorous, and has a very good mind and an extremely good economic grasp, but that it is too early for her to be considered as a leader. Now, we've had, of course, a situation going back to 1974 when Edward Heath's Conservatives won an election and were brought down by Orgreave Colliery, by Arthur Scargill's NUM members, Yorkshire. He then called an election in 75 and they lost. And in 1975, the Conservative Party held a leadership election, and a complete outsider, a woman who nobody really knew anything about, she was education secretary, and she was known as the woman who took school milk away from the children, somehow or other, with a few people behind her, who managed somehow to win the election because Heath was so very, very unpopular, and was seen as being, you know, in the classic phrase determined much earlier back in the 1960s, yesterday's man.
Yes, this is something, I'm just interjecting here, this is something I've always wondered about with regards to the things that you hear kind of like, you know, the kind of old grizzled working class Britons complaining about with regards to Thatcher. I'm sure they have lots of things to complain about, so I'd be open to hearing their complaints. However, the two things they seem to focus on, which I always thought was really strange, was this thing with the taking the milk away from children, quote unquote. These are the same people who should agree with me that, why are human beings drinking cow's milk to such a large extent anyway? And why would you want to be essentially funneling government money toward an industry which at that time was so corrupt?
Well, first of all, cow's milk, I think it's got something to do with the Labour Party's view of the starving poor, which may or may not have been true in 1945, But they're probably harking back to the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and the view of these kids who have no shoes when they were trying to create this brave new world after the war. That creation, of course, came to a stop in 1951 when I was born, not because I was born, although I've always considered myself important enough to be a world historical event, of course, but because the Conservatives were elected with Churchill, who served for some years before he was replaced by Eden. And we then ran into 1956 and the Suez Crisis and the arising of Macmillan. And this was a period of great growth and you've never had it so good and all this sort of thing was happening. And the world that the Labour Party thought they were creating with their free milk was completely of the past at that point. So I really think that in a way they never escaped, old Labour never escaped that image of the past, which they were trying to serve with the struggle of the unions, which turned in the 1970s into a totally destructive engagement with the business world, fundamentally trying to create out of struggle, industrial struggle, trying to create the socialist future. And when Thatcher came, she came with an absolute right, political right, to put an end to that type of politics, to that type of thinking. So when she took the milk away from the children, she was only in microcosm foretelling what, some years later, she would be doing as Prime Minister of the country. And she put an end to the socialist vision of the future forever.
Even the way that Scargill behaved when Baroness Castle and whoever it was, Harold Wilson Command 3888. If they had actually allowed that to go through, then the entire history would probably have been different from that time going forward.
Yeah, we may never have had a Thatcher. It's true.
Exactly. Because at that point in time, there were only three choices. There was either going to be a Thatcher-type thing was going to happen, or in place of strife was going to pass through, or there was going to be a government of national salvation with the Queen suspending Parliament and the usual armed suspects coming out and taking control of airports so that people cannot fly in and out. Seriously, they actually had human beings in military uniforms were actually at the airports around that time who were supposed to leap into action if that was going to happen. And the person who was going to be Prime Minister of the Government of National Salvation, quote unquote, was no. It was supposed to be Lord Mountbatten of Burma.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they were going to put him in as the person. Mm. But it didn't happen, and the reason it didn't happen was because the British people, the British people, I put this in quotation marks, air quotes, if you will, managed to find a different solution to the problem, which was that the unions refused to actually come to the negotiating table at all anyway, so that ruled them out, and then Margaret Thatcher appeared. So everyone kind of took their foot off the pedal at this point.
Yeah. Oh, I think from a security point of view, Thatcher was a wonderful thing. I mean, she enabled the country to regain its self-respect in the Falklands conflict and the armed services to regain their prestige.
The other thing that is mentionable is this thing with the coal miners and so on. Now, we know the story them going on strike and it didn't work and, there were these huge acrimonious fights because of the fact that, they didn't want to lose their jobs and so on. Yep. However, these are then the same people who are talking about global warming and pollution, for example. What is a coal mine other than the most dirty thing you can possibly think of in terms of this kind of thing? So when I hear people still talking about this now, I'm kind of thinking, well, yes, it was bad, but wasn't it also technically good for the entire planet, though, that this had to wind up eventually? Like, what would they have liked to do? Continue to mine coal until eventually we end up in the hydrogen age?
Yeah, because what we've just seen in the Brexit debate is the Labour Party coming forward with a vision of human value that is economic. They are only interested in the preservation of workers' rights. That's it. That's what the EU does. Therefore, we can ignore every other aspect of it, because that's all secondary. We don't care about sovereignty, really. We're pretty sort of lukewarm about democratic rights, to be honest. We're not concerned about the lack of democracy in the EU. But the workers' rights, you know, that's the thing. Amazingly,
it's a very narrow conception of workers' rights that they have as well, because if they think about it in full, there's an externality that they're ignoring. If they say, oh, well, yeah, you know, you should continue to mine the coal mines forever, there's an economic price that they still have to pay for that. It just comes later.
But it's worth it for the jobs. You see, if you're part of this world,
I just want to interject one thing. That's the reason to get away from the strictly Marxist definition of the left, because it's not comprehensive.
Well, I'm very happy.
It's prone to mistakes like that.
Well, I wouldn't even say that it's Marxism per se, because where is that kind of those sentimentalist nostalgia to be found anywhere in the text of Marx, for example?
Well, no,
it'd be very hard pressed to find that stuff there.
No, but that would be. An outgrowth of the fact that you're only paying attention to the workers and to their particular jobs and protecting them, whether the kind of job and the kind of worker is worthwhile or not.
Marx described the what he called the lumpen proletariat.
Yeah.
I read this morning. He described the lumpen proletariat as beggars, prostitutes, gangsters, racketeers, swindlers, petty criminals, tramps, chronic unemployed or unemployables. And you know, he idealized the proletariat per se, but it was a political intelligentsia. You know, the working class intelligentsia was going to arise and would express itself in the form in which he was laying out. But all the great body
Althusser says the same thing as well.
Highly conservative people who actually constitute the working class. They're very, very conservative, grounded part of society. So we've got already, you know, in this classical Marxist division, we've got, you know, you are a racist or you are a bigot. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister, most powerful man in the country, telling a little woman she is a bigot, you know, or describing the little woman as a bigot, because that is him saying, I belong to the true expression of working class politics. I am.
But then that might connect to the criticism of my trying to bring all the people under England under one rubric, say.
I didn't want to get there yet. The thing that I'm going to say first before I get to that is what they've all forgotten, these people who are going around talking about, you know, racism, bigotry, etc., when they talk about the migration issue, is they forgot that if they were to apply the standards which they are presently deploying now, they would have to accuse Marx himself of being a quote-unquote racist bigot, because of the fact that during the time when he was on the First International, which was a group of 32 councillors, I think it was, 32 councillors on the First International, it was actually Marx himself, from his own mouth, who wrote, and I'm just going to read the quote off to you. To give an example, one of the commonest forms of the movement for emancipation is that of strikes. Formerly, when a strike took place in one country, it was defeated by the importation of workmen from another. The First International has nearly stopped all of that. It receives information of the intended strikes. It spreads that information among its members, who at once see for them that the seat of the struggle must be forbidden ground. The masters are thus left alone to reckon with their men. In most cases, the men require no other aid than that. Their own subscriptions or those of the societies to which they are more immediately affiliated supply them with funds, but should the pressure upon them become too heavy and the strike be one of which the association approves, their necessities are supplied out of the common purse. By these means, a strike of the cigar makers in Barcelona was brought to a victorious issue the other day. What is he talking about here? He's actually describing a situation in Barcelona where they were holding a strike and the bourgeoisie thought to themselves, oh, what we'll do is we'll just import some foreign migrants, hit you with them, and then what are you going to do then? And of course, Marx's response to this was, well, you're not allowed to bring migrants here because we say so. So if you were to say this now, to say that, you know, one of the ways to strike back against the exploitation of workers is to block migrants from entering the country, what would they call Marx now? They would say that he's a racist. They'd say that he's not even properly a Marxist, even though he is literally Karl Marx. it's incredible. So mm-hmm. when I see these kind of things, you know, it becomes very difficult for me to then look at this and say, okay, well, you know, they've gotten this from Marx. Because if they were to actually read Marx, they would find a completely different human being than they actually think that they're talking about.
I'm sure you're right. Mm.
The same thing with Althusser as well. Althusser stands around incessantly. He has an article called Marxism as a Weapon of Theory or something like this. Philosophy as a Weapon of Theory or something like this that he wrote in 1968. I'm going to read a quotation from that as well. He has written here, "To struggle against the bourgeois and petty bourgeois world outlook, which always threatened Marx's theory and which deeply impregnates today. The general form of this world outlook," and he's talking about the bourgeois in this case, "the general form of this world outlook is economism, today known as technocracy, and its spiritual complement," which he has put in quotation marks, "ethical idealism, which today is known as humanism. Economism and ethical idealism have constituted a basic opposition in the bourgeois world outlook since the origins of the bourgeoisie. The current philosophical form of this world outlook, neo-positivism and its spiritual complement, existentialist phenomenological subjectivism, the variant peculiar to the human sciences, the ideology called structuralism." And so, basically, Althusser is here criticizing structuralism. He's saying that humanism is nonsense, technocracy, and so on. He throws all of these things out. So when you see these people walking around claiming to be Marxist humanists, I like to remind them that, you know, Althusser said that humanism and Marxism are actually incompatible. You cannot be a Marxist and then turn around and say that you're a humanist at the end of it, because humanism is ethical idealism, the very thing which it was supposed to come to overturn. And so all of these things, it's very easy to catch these so-called left people in all kinds of interesting...
Because he was trying to redefine the whole thing. I mean, you know, up to the point where he had his episode and killed his wife, he was the leading exponent of this process of redefinition. And in a way, he was the last exponent of it, because the point of focus after Althusser, it became...
Frankfurt.
Gramsci. No, not Frankfurt. Frankfurt was already gone. Gramsci.
It went from
Derrida, Althusser, Gramsci. But Gramsci, of course, died in 1950-something, rather. You know, the little prisoner of Turin with the hunchback.
There are overlaps between him and Althusser, though.
There was no living theorist to move beyond
to rebut
that.
What we're doing.
And in intellectual terms, the advancement of the egalitarian process had come to a halt. And it's very apparent that over the last 15 or 20 years, in fact, there's been no further energetic ideological advancement at all. They're now reduced to things like looking at Thomas Piketty, you know, and trying to find some way of dealing with...
Okay, so when you're talking about equalitarianism, you're talking about a red left, you say that you can't do it under the rubric of the left. Well, I guess you can't do it under the rubric of the left, but a white left is certainly viable.
Well, you know, you're talking about half of the... In the European context, the liberal world of the European peoples, the left and the right are two halves of a polity. And these terms are extremely well grounded and have a very long history in terms of just general semantics.
The white left is not well grounded because there's nobody. It's a completely new term.
It's a completely new term.
It's a neologism that would beg the question.
I would say this. Which side of the spectrum would both of the two of you say that you are on at this point?
I'm a nationalist.
Yeah, I am a nationalist, but I'm also instinctually conservative. I don't mean in the political sense. I believe that every people is an instinctually conservative organism.
Right, and so is ecology. But the opposite of liberalism and conservatism is some form of unionization or another. Some sort of delimitation. You're in or you're out. You know, it's not just like anything goes.
There's an underlying
concept of unionization, whether it's national citizenship or some other form.
I think what you're guessing at really, but even though you call it unionization, I think what you're guessing at really is that in a modern economy, you can't overlook the fact that workers comprise most of the population. So anytime you have an ideology which someone might refer to as populist, you would have to have empowerment of the persons that you are appealing to. So, for example, if you say that 67% of the British population is working class, for example, then you wouldn't, it would not be viable to try to have an ideology which ignores their existence. That's what you're really saying, isn't it?
And also, it's not viable to have an ideology that lets happen what's happened by the political class and its treachery.
This is the thing that's been said in ethnonationalism quite a lot, that, you know, no organism wants to accept change without resistance.
Exactly.
If it can continue on in its present form, it will strive to do so because everything in the world is inherently, well, everything biologically speaking, I mean, not ideologically or politically, I mean, but everything biologically speaking is inherently conservative in the sense that it does not want to have its form changed against its will.
Exactly so. We have to understand that the kind of expression that nationalists seek is a very simple thing. It isn't like the liberal concept of highly extended, highly attenuated line of thinking that leads to ever new avenues of new vistas of understanding and so forth. This is not a moving process in that way. It's not a process at all. It's simply a discovery of self. It's simply a discovery of interest. It's simply an expression of that discovery, and out of that everything else emerges. That is the totality of nationalist movement. The great problem that WN has at the moment is that it is trying, on the one hand, because it must, to engender, to light up the these feelings and senses and instincts. But on the other hand, it's trying to impose an idealistic Nietzschean teleology. It's trying to say you have to be, you know, we've got to fight battles and you have to be a tough, hard warrior and, you know, Aryan this and that, the other. And it's trying to impose a uniform, a structure that is not part of its own nature.
I would say that's an accurate characterization of one significant strand of white nationalist advocacy nowadays, yes.
And this is creating a great problem because, you know, if you call to young men particularly and you give them a vision of their own realization in a heroic mold, they will respond to that. That is a fact. They will respond to that. But it isn't true of
all of
the
society.
Young man himself, or of all of society.
It may also be that the kind of persons who are willing to be the spearhead tend to have a tendency toward this kind of, you know, great character who's striking down everyone with a sword kind of person.
Yeah, it may also be because
of the fact that they're almost self-selecting for this.
It may also be that the fantastical difficulty of coming to a understanding of the world, a really good understanding of the world, is a filter for such people. That only those who are really motivated can battle through and begin to put together for themselves some kind of understanding at any level, even the one that's imputed by the Southern Law Poverty Centre to Tommy Mayer with his desire to acquire regalia or arms information from the National Alliance some many, many years ago, if that's true. Even that shows a desire to find something real in a world in which there is really only deception and dystopia. People strive for that, and mad people looking for sanity, you know, could quite easily find something there, something to cling to, something to search for. You know, so you would expect a lot of marginalized people, along with the most competent people, to be found amongst the nationalist body. As, of course, the liberalism begins to break down and things begin to change, and you know, what's now called populism begins to function, that body would increase in number, and more, you know, ordinary folk, as it were, who haven't been through this process because it's been given to them so much more easily, begin to appear. And some of the extremes of nationalist thinking and nationalist talk, nationalist practice, will fade away. I think that's highly likely. And I think also that what I'm talking about in terms of an existentialist form of nationalism is really the form of nationalism that, that would meld best intellectually with a populist movement. Seem to be in a situation as a blog where we're alone, virtually alone.
Well, we can talk about why that is tomorrow.
Yes, we can talk about it tomorrow. Perhaps we've done enough for today.
Yeah, and I'd like Kumiko to define populism. Maybe tomorrow, though.
Okay. Yes, I'll try to do that.
We could start with that. So, should we call it a day today?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much.